a process we've seen similar to other places where the military junta allows an opening, but still retains a great deal of power. And what happened in 2015 was Aung San Suu Kyi won an election, and then again in 2020, she won a election by even wider margins, and the military junta essentially said, okay, that's enough. And in February 2021, we had this coup.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. We are your hosts, Rory McElhone. I do the podcast bits, and I am joined by Robert Morse, who has been looking at all the news you haven't had time to.
Indeed. Good to see everybody in this new year. How are things with you, Rory?
Yeah, things are going well. Just back at work, the usual oil struggle. So it's nice to sit down and record a little podcast.
Well, we're excited here in New York. We might have snow this weekend for the first time in 2 years.
Wow, in 2 years? That's incredible.
Yeah. There was always snow on the ground when I was growing up in this region, and that is no longer the case.
Yes. Also, it seems to be quite a warm winter for Europe as well. There hasn't really been much frost at all this year.
Yeah, nice to not use all that gas, I guess. But
yes.
It doesn't bode well. Doesn't bode well.
No, but it is a weird irony that the reason we don't need as many fossil fuels at the moment is because of all the fossil fuels that we previously used.
Yeah, you know, isn't there some kind of scientific term for that, right? There's equilibrium or something, maintaining a certain equilibrium.
Yeah.
Something, I don't know, math, science, not really my thing.
Are you aware of a certain region that might have Arctic tundra and desert?
Wow, really? That's actually,
It's got an incredible amount of biomes.
Yes, it's got a lot of biomes, it's got a lot of people ohms, it's got a lot going on in Myanmar, which is the topic of today's presentation.
I thought as a proud American, you'd be calling it Burma.
You know, that it does seem like the U.S. government is the sole holdout. The confusion, the Myanmar, the Burma thing came because usually when a country decides to rename itself, the international community sort of grumbles and moves on. But after an earlier coup, not the 21 coup that we're talking about, that we will talk about or touch on briefly, but an earlier coup back in, I believe, 1990, or was it? Yeah, I believe 1990.
The 90s coup, yes. Okay, is that the 888 uprising?
I think there was the 888 uprising that led to elections that initially put Aung San Suu Kyi in power, and the military said no. And as part of the sort of nationalist push, after throwing Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest, they decided to rename the country to Myanmar. And I think a lot of the international community was like, hey, you are not a legitimate government. We are not getting on board with this name change. But it does seem that through the, you know, in the ensuing 30 years, more and more people are leaning towards Myanmar, with the great exception of the U.S. government. Which is a bit surprising because there was a decade in there where relations between the United States and Burma's government were actually pretty good, but we maintained Burma rather than Myanmar. So,
is this one of the regions where you can say Britain caused a lot of the issues?
Absolutely, and we'll get there. But just sort of by way of introduction. We had a bit of confusion. You know, we were discussing, you know, I can't believe we haven't done a Myanmar episode yet. You know, we should do two episodes. There is so much here. But I think what happened was, we were sort of defeated by just how much there is here. So instead of a multi-part series, we're going to be doing a sort of single episode. And I think this mirrors the way a lot of governments outside of Myanmar have faced the conflict. This is Myanmar. I think a lot of people get sort of excited about a lot of not, you know, people who don't perhaps have the world's best interests at heart, people in China and the United States.
What
who are looking
would the
for...
term be from someone from Myanmar, Myanmarians?
Oh, I don't know. but just to finish the thought, I think that a lot of people love the idea of Burma because of where it's located as a site for sort of proxy warring. I think China has to be involved in Myanmar to some degree, and the United States kind of loves the idea of figuring a way to sort of put more of a hand in. That's something that we really tried very hard to do in the early Obama administration, which looked like with some great success. But I think the lesson of that and sort of the disaster to which that has fallen kind of indicate a lesson that Burma keeps teaching, is that Myanmar, I'm doing it now, I can't stop it. It's just a little too big, a little too powerful, and a little bit too much of a mess for an outside power to have as much influence as it would like to.
You know, the media will portray it as there's just the one government and the rebels, but it feels like every region has its own militia and its own energy, and it almost feels like if one of them can, you know, control the capital, they control everything. It seems to be a horrible hellscape at the moment.
Well, I think the media is really portraying that, and I think that it's interesting. I can't say that I've got any kind of expertise in Myanmar, but from following Myanmar for, sort of half following Myanmar for, I guess, gosh, a decade now, I can say that I do think that the media is getting a little over its skis. Specifically, the motivating factor for why we're talking about this would be the 1027 offensive, a interesting coalition of ethnic rebel groups in some kind of relationship that I couldn't quite tease out. And frankly, I don't think many journalists are teasing out.
Everybody against the military?
Well, that's the way that we're hearing about it. And that's certainly the way that a lot of the opposition forces are marketing it. But I spent some time this morning looking into the National Unity Government, which is the successor of the elected
previous
government.
Yes. So it gets confusing because you're used to thinking the government and the military are allied. But here the government has broke away, tried to be peaceful, then made their own military, told every other militia, let's go after the military that's taken charge in a coup. It's all very messy.
Well, what happened is in February 2021, the Tatmadaw, and I think perhaps the reason why everyone uses the word Tatmadaw is because they want to distinguish the military junta that has run the country on and off for decades at this point. In 2011, they decided to let Aung San Suu Kyi, the daughter of someone who is sometimes described as the father of Burmese independence or what have you, a guy who was quickly assassinated when he tried to be in power. So the Tatmadaw let Aung San Suu Kyi out of jail in 2011, began to allow there to be elections. In 2015, Aung San Suu Kyi won that election. But this is a process we've seen similar to other places where the military junta allows an opening, but still retains a great deal of power. And what happened in 2015 was Aung San Suu Kyi won an election, and then again in 2020, she won a election by even wider margins, and the military junta essentially said, okay, that's enough. And in February 2021, we had this coup.
Basically said that the 2020 election was null and void.
Exactly. I think that the media, I think quite rightly, a lot of outsized media is confused by this conflict and is quite rightly biased against the Tatmadaw and the military junta, which stinks. They're awful. They have done awful things.
But are they the closest thing to like a international government that this country has? Like if you were to meet with delegates in the European Union, say, you're going to see a representative from them, I take it?
To the extent that any such representative is welcomed, yes. I mean, they are the government. And I think that there's a lot of there's two parallels that come up that lead me to believe that, like, sort of the U.S. media, the Western media, just world media perception of, like, oh, it's this hellscape of war and all against all. It's not actually the case. It is a place with incredibly long-standing wars. These ethnic groups have been fighting, different mixes of these ethnic groups, have been fighting since independence.
I've heard it's described as the longest-running armed conflict that's currently going on.
Yeah, it is an 80-year conflict in some ways. But I think at a given point, any particular ethnic militia has been you know, there has been ongoing war at all times. But it's also, you know, for a lot of the past decade, it was becoming a big tourist destination, even though some of this fighting was ongoing. What has happened is that for not the first time, well, to some extent, the first time after this February 2021 coup, the majority of the Burmese population is actually, to some extent that is not clear, involved in military resistance against the Tatmadaw. The Tatmadaw is, to some extent, has clearly represented the interests of the ethnic majority of Myanmar, which are the Bamar people, which is the name from which both Burma and Myanmar are derived from, which is like 68% of the population. I looked at a, which is a very key thing to do when I'm looking at any conflict where I'm not entirely certain what the media is telling me is true, is I just look at a population density map. And if you look at a population density map, you'll find that with the exception of Rakhine State, none of the places where there is ongoing military combat are places where a high density of Myanmar people live. So, and I think that much like, do you remember with Ethiopia about 2 years ago with Abiy Ahmed, you know, the prime minister of a country of 110 million, everybody in U.S. media started talking about how he's about to be overthrown by an ethnic minority of 6 million people. And that proved to be nonsense. And I think that the 1027, you know, October 27th, offensive by some amorphous grouping of these ethnic militias, possibly with some endorsement from the ousted government that does represent the majority of the country to some extent. You know, I think people have gotten very excited about what is indisputably a great setback for the Tatmadaw, for the military junta. But if you look into the details a bit more, the biggest new step is that apparently always been some degree of fighting in Shan State. The junta has really, really experienced massive setbacks. Losing multiple outposts, losing border crossings with China, very big deal. I don't want to, you know, say that that's not a big deal, but I think a lot of people are portraying this as the junta's on their last legs. They're about to fall apart. When in reality, they still control all of the major population centers of the country, and are fairly. I think there's a possibility, a hope, that their setbacks will convince the Tatmadaw for the benefit of the country that, okay, maybe it's time to be kinder to Aung San Suu Kyi or do another deal with these forces so we can sort of get things together to consolidate control of the country. I think the general picture being portrayed here that the junta is about to fall apart and the National Unity Government, the NUG, is about to happily march into the capital, which I cannot pronounce, or even the center of population, the old capital, Yangon, is going to, I think those expectations are a little blown out of proportion. And I think that the story we're being told is a little, it's exciting. It's good to see a nasty coup-making junta lose, but I think that that's giving a lot of people an unfair impression of how shaky that junta is. I think that it's not a question of the Tatmadaw falling militarily. It's a question of the Tatmadaw losing enough to be convinced that negotiation and a return to sort of the 2020 dispensation might be a better idea. Seems like the more realistic possibility of hope for me. The idea of these various ethnic liberation armies being able to, you know, march on actual Myanmar cities or something, which is not something that I'm seeing suggested anywhere.
Is there anything you could see that will ever stop this ethnic tension, considering it has been so long running?
Well, that's a great segue to just how long running this is. You might remember James C. Scott. We discussed the guy, the against the grain guy, who's he's probably the most well respected most impressive, frankly, libertarian-leaning intellectual that there has been. He wrote a book, Seeing Like a State, that's tremendously influential. One of his more recent books, I guess before Against the Grain, was The Art of Not Being Governed. And it focused on exactly this territory. I think it's referred to as Zomia, not as if it is a particular nationality or people. It is a bewildering diversity of peoples and nationalities created by the geography that spreads across Burma, Thailand, parts of China, and into India.
And Bangladesh.
Yes, in Bangladesh. And it's just this incredible diversity of peoples that, much like certain parts of Afghanistan, just have managed to remain invulnerable to any kind of state influence for a very, very long period of time. Myanmar, formerly Burma in particular, has had sort of the loudest and most obvious difficulty in subjugating these mountain peoples. It is sort of a broader story. So this, even before the British, even before the variety of Bamar empires, this was a long-standing problem. These are parts that are not, you know, have not been hard to control for decades. They are parts that have never really been controlled by centralized state authority. And that's sort of the deeper story here. And of course, as you referenced at the beginning, the British managed to come in and find ways to further screw things up. There were apparently a series of Bamar empires, other empires as well, other groups that the British crushed across the course of the 19th century in three Anglo-Burmese wars, slowly working its way up the sort of Burmese, if you look at a map of Burma, working their way up from the coast. And by 1885, modern Burma was sort of entirely consolidated. What's interesting is that something I've always found fascinating is, you know, we think of Burma, we think of Myanmar as a, for lack of a better word, perhaps this is my own prejudices, I think of it as a sort of East Asian country, you know, just in terms of, you know, how people look there and how the Buddhism is tremendously important. My sense of like sort of the visual stereotypes of Burma are sort of East Asian, but it was very much a part of British India. You know, Burma, of course, right next to Bangladesh, right next to India. But it seems like more of an East Asian country, but it was very much a part of British India. And that has, you know, kind really important implications for how Burma was governed. An interesting dynamic that was brought up in the context of the Rohingya genocide as a terrible and not at all justifiable excuse for what was happening to the Rohingya people, who present as more sort of Bangladeshi, sort of more South Asian, is that they were seen as representatives of the British colonizers. The British India used Indian troops primarily to enforce its power and its borders. So that meant that the Burmese people had a tremendous resentment for Indian-looking folks.
But also, wouldn't the Indians have also done a lot of the sort of middle-class jobs, a lot of the administration?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the many, many neglected population transfers, is that when the British left, I think it's 1947 is Indian partition. I think it's 1948 where they also, you know, firmly gave up on Burma as part of that process. And I believe there was a large population transfer of an Indian middle class back to India out of Burma, because the Burmese nationalists, understandably to some degree, did not have much interest in this Indian middle class being there. The other key thing about British time and power is that, and this was the case in India as well, but was, I think, stronger with that Zomia aspect of these sort of mountain communities that had never really been governed, is that after coming in and taking out the major power that actually threatened Britain or was a competitor to Britain, they were quite content to allow a high degree of autonomy to these regions, or simply to just sort of never go there. It's like, as long as there's a British flag and you're not doing deals with the Russians or the Chinese, what do we care? I think seems to have been the sort of consistent attitude across British India. In the aftermath of 1857, this is broader British India history, the First War of Indian Independence, British policy across British India became, okay, we'll do deals with local rulers. If you're a Maharaja, a satrap of some sort, a sultan, we're happy to say you're still in charge, you just, you know, and we'll treat you nice and we'll give you corruption opportunities, but you're nominally independent. And I think there was some of that in Burma as well. And the great distinction between India, which very quickly, under the guided, I think under the leadership of Vallabhai Patel, the guy with the tallest statue in human history or something, he basically very quickly crushed all of those independent princely states or what have you. With some really grim repercussions in Kashmir would be one example, but broadly India was able to sort of crush all their autonomous regions. The independent nationalist Burmese state builders of the 1940s did not do that, tried to do that, started wars to try to do that, and those wars are still ongoing today. So that's sort of the sort of interminable context that we're talking about here. And it's I think you can make a good argument, I've not studied this to the extent that I should, that during the period between 2011 and 2021, when the Tatmadaw was opening to the West, opening to Aung San Suu Kyi,
is this when there's a photo opportunity of Aung San Suu Kyi and Obama? Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Because she's a darling of them. I mean, she's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, darling of the West. So I think you can make a great case that during that period of opening, there was a lot of progress with the militias. There were ongoing ceasefires. There was a national ceasefire attempt that maybe half of the militias signed on to. But it's also important to remember that this is also the time period of the Rohingya genocide. Yeah, I think that's a little unfair to say, oh, well, you know, there was a genocide happening, so that's completely... I think it's true that a ongoing democratic process was allowed to continue for another decade or two, I believe that that is the only way to actually solve this process, get these communities the amount of autonomy that they need to participate in the national life of the country in general. I don't think many of these militias have much interest in independence. I'm sure some of them have been, or you know, have it on their websites or what have you.
Because they seem to flip flop in what their morals seem to be, depending on you know the decade.
Of course. I mean, it's been going for 80 years, you know, it's very different things have been popular during most of a century.
Because I've heard about one, you linked me a podcast to do a bit of research. Well, one of these armed groups is making money from a mobile phone game, is that right?
Well, I think, is that the cyber scamming thing? I mean...
Yeah, something like that. It's just the incredible variety of these groups, and just they seem to be all, you know, it's almost like they're little statelets of their own. It's like this sort of experiment of Burma isn't quite a nation state, but yet we all kind of try to force it to be.
Well, I think is key, and I think is neglected in a lot of the Western coverage, is that there is very much a nation state of Myanmar that has a large, you know, largely consistent ethnic population, incredible potential for business, you know, people.
Huge natural resources.
Yeah, but that on the margins, within the penciled border of Myanmar, there are a variety of mini states that have no allegiance to that. So I think that there is, and I think this is a lot of people are getting, even, you know, the European bureaucracies are getting a little too far out in saying that, oh, okay, this impressive coalition of militias, you know, is potentially the backing the real government, of Myanmar. And I really don't. I don't buy that. I just don't. That podcast that I sent you, I'm not actually going to reference it because
Okay.
No. You're welcome to reference it, but I'm not going to link it because I think it starts off with like, it's like a bunch of like U.S. military guys.
Well, they're more about the equipment. They're talking about how certain regions have like German G3s and others are using the Chinese AKs. And they're more about the hardware of the conflict.
And I found it interesting, but it started off with like an anti-Asian ethnic slur, you know, like, I'm certainly not linking to that. It was interesting. And it I think it's indicative of a lot of sort of Western military folks, communities look at Myanmar, because initially they're like, oh, wow, this would be a great place to like, you know, stick it to the Chinese. But then the more they look at it, they're like, oh, my God, like this is actually quite intimidating and fascinating, as you indicated, just the incredible diversity of forces. It's like if there weren't such extraordinary human consequences, including genocide over the past decade, it really does. It's like Mad Max mixed with like a Age of Empires video game. You know,
you're also seeing a lot of like drone footage, the stuff we'd expect to see from Ukraine. We're also seeing here. We're seeing army posts being overrun, but it's like there's just so much going on. It's hard to know. It's not like here's just one side and the other. It's like, yeah, these ethnic groups are going to fight amongst each other as well as the junta as well. It's just sort of reminds you of how miserable, depressing, and pointless a lot of war is.
And it's just the complexity of it and the insanity of it and the fundamental mismatch of a lot of it is, you know, you've got some militia forces that are, you know, would put any group of, the Ukrainian or Russian military to shame. And then you've got smaller groups that are just, a bunch of guys with machetes and you know, whatever the relevant AK-47 analog is. Probably AK-47s, I don't know. So, yeah, and of course, then you factor in the participation of other
Type
governments.
56, that's it. The Chinese version of the AK is what a lot of the stuff's based on, so the Type 56.
Ah, there you are. But so, yeah, and it's, you know, I think that China specifically, the United States as well, are sort of intimidated and just kind of like, how do we jump into this? Because it's just so confusing. But that does not mean that they have not been, arming a variety of militia groups. And then, of course, there's the whole drug aspect.
Yes. Was it something like the world's biggest producer of meth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, and meth, heroin, and this goes back to the Vietnam War, you know, just incredible.
But it reminds me a lot of the classic places to grow drugs is just incredibly inhospitable remote regions. And we do have jungles, desert, and mountains. You know, when I talk about the Arctic tundra, that's the region, we're touching the Himalayas and then we're bordering Laos and Thailand. It's just outstandingly massive and inhospitable to get to, so it's a perfect location for all sorts of dodgy things.
And I think the reason we wanted to do this overview is to emphasize that like this like sort of Mad Max Thunderdome special operator nightmare slash heaven is located incredibly strategically. It probably does border India at some points. But
oh, yes. Well, sadly, it could be incredibly wealthy. Like something that's great is just having a lot of other countries neighboring you, because it makes imports really cheap. And obviously, then people want to transport through you, which you can benefit from. So yes, it borders Bangladesh, India, China, Laos, and Thailand.
The strategic importance of this country is so large that especially if Washington, D.C. gets the new Cold War that it wants, it strikes me as inevitable, not necessarily this decade, but in the decades to come, that Myanmar becomes a battleground of some sort.
Well, what's also great from an American standpoint is if your cash cow of hyping up a Chinese invasion dies away, you can then flip straight to India.
There you go. Yeah. So it's just imagine like something. I'm trying to think of like European analogs, but just imagine if there was a sort of Mad Max Thunderdome between Germany and France.
Well, it's kind of like Switzerland in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. The fact it's so mountainous, because it's not just one mountain range. It basically, you know, a lot of its border is basically because it's got mountains to India, it's got mountains to China, which keeps it, you know, insular and protected. So a bit like a Switzerland with a port, but everyone's at war all the time, like feudal Japan.
Yeah, that's a brilliant parallel, and I think very telling, and I think makes a lot of sense. It's been a battle. It's been an imperial battleground before. The details are escaping me, but I think it was one of the last big Japanese pushes was into Burma.
Mm-hmm. That seemed to be where the Japan's reach went a bit too far. And I think, did the government like the Japanese and then change their mind when they noticed they were losing?
Exactly. Well, it wasn't the government. It was sort of the nationalist, the nationalist resistance to the British, figured, oh, the Japanese can really help us. And then, oh wait, the Japanese are losing. So we'll be part of the heroic resistance forces. But I think the Japanese really hated
anyone
Burma.
That wasn't Japanese.
Well, there's that as well. They're famously not a, famously pretty horrifically cruel occupiers, but they were really bothered by Burma because that was the staging point for a lot of aid across the Himalayas. They used to call it, I think they call it the hump, over the hump. The Allies during World War II were based in what was then British Burma, and used that as a staging area for a lot of aid to Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist Chinese leader who was fighting against the Japanese invasion. So that was sort of the back door into China. And that was why the Japanese were so interested in slamming that door shut. That, I believe, was a big push that was stopped by the British, the Americans, the Indians, and the Burmese. And that was a rather significant battle of World War II that nobody really talks about. But the Chiang Kai-shek was a large-scale beneficiary of Lend-Lease funds, you know, the similar programs that the United States used to support the Russians and the British. And the Chinese, specifically Roosevelt himself, saw supporting the Chinese as probably not equally as important, but really emphasized that it was incredibly important to support the Chinese against the Japanese. And a lot of that went through Burma. And I think a lot of those dynamics and frankly, surplus military hardware indicate why, you know, just a few years after Burma being a massive battleground with Japanese arms and U.S. arms and arms that were supposed to be going to China that didn't quite make it, starts to indicate why the Burmese nationalists who tried to set up an independent country in 1948 had such immediate, incredible difficulties.
Because the country's just awash with weapons.
Exactly. And I think we've seen that dynamic in many parts of Africa and the Middle East to their detriment over the past decade. But I think Burma's been dealing with that for eight decades. Sorry, Myanmar has been dealing with that for eight decades.
What do you think's been the outside country that sort of created the most amount of destabilization?
Well, I mean, I think the outside country that is becoming the most, mostly because it kind of has to, is China. And I think that
it does have a massive border with China.
Massive border with China. I was sort of interested, like, I think that podcast that we're not going to link to, because they make nasty jokes, mentioned an obscenely large figure for Chinese Belt and Road investments.
But if there's one place where you would put investment in, as China, it's going to be Myanmar.
No, oh, of course, or you'd like to if you could. But they mentioned this obscenely large figure, and I was like, that doesn't sound right. And I looked into it, and as of 2020, 9 of 40 Belt and Road projects proposed for China have actually broken the ground. Proposed by China for Myanmar have actually broken the ground. Because it's a war zone.
Okay. I was going to say, does this show just how terrible Myanmar is, or how terrible and overhyped the Belt and Road is? Because if you look at a map, this is exactly where you just want railways and motorways and everything, because it's huge mountain. And then once you get past that mountain region, it's quite flat all the way to the Bay of Bengal. So you skip a massive amount of transport going through a classic Chinese choke point and brings you right beside India and the rest of the world. So you just hemorrhage money into that region. And if they can't, it does show just how incredibly difficult it is.
Well, it's a testament to a number of things, Rory, but I think probably most of all is the still, I think many places are beginning to wake up and come out of this, of the persistent, frantic, panicked fire hose of bullcrap in most coverage of Belt and Road. The most, like, oh, did you know that China signed a $400 billion deal with Iran? And people still quote that at me, despite the fact that it was the most pie-in-the-sky number, literally pulled out of a hat by somebody at Newsweek or something, and it just became the conventional wisdom. My understanding is that the largest by far recipient of Belt and Road funds is Pakistan, and that is still under $100 billion. That's real, though. I mean, I think we've discussed before, the China-Pakistan economic corridor is like, this is the real strategic goal of Belt and Road. This is the stuff that really matters. This is China's back door in the event of an invasion of Taiwan and losing their access to the whole. I mean, that's a real big deal. China would love to set up a similar corridor with Myanmar.
Because then you basically you also can surround India from both sides.
Exactly. China would love to be able to do that. It'd be shorter, it'd be more straightforward. But that, as difficult as the transition through Xinjiang to Pakistan is, just from a transit difficulty, building things, the transition through this Zomia region that we've been discussing as a space of constant warfare for 80 years is so much more difficult. So while I don't doubt for a second that $100 or $200 billion worth of deals between China and Myanmar have been proposed, I do doubt that many have been actually signed, but certainly tens of billions of dollars worth of deals have been signed. What's actually going to get produced and built is much more up in the air.
But also, is it just difficult to do deals? Because you can do deals with the government and then, oh, now they're throwing out and out some military guy. And even if you do the deals, they might sort of go, yeah, we do run the country, but that region, we don't really get on with them too well. So we can't build the road there. Like, is there just a lot of just kind of confusing molasses that's kind of like, what's the point in even dealing with these people?
Absolutely. It's a very sad testament to the consistency and reliability of Myanmar's governing systems that Pakistan is a much better customer.
Yes, you make Pakistan look like a normal country.
Pakistan at least, you know, might have a bunch of coups, but at least it has a large...
They can all stand behind one cricketer, while I don't think you can say the same about Myanmar.
Yes. Well, they could buy, actually, the cricketer is now in jail, but it's one consolidated system. It is one, like, it had certain, and don't get me wrong, there's Balochistan has its own rebel groups, but they have rebel groups that carry out terror attacks. Myanmar has rebel groups that maintain military schools, like maintain their own
and produce their own weapons.
Yes, like are their own functioning states that control their own territory and have done so for decades. That is a problem that Myanmar has and Pakistan does not. So
is China scared to get involved? You know, when you consider how much work China's done to basically implement like a one Chinese identity, and then you have a country that's incredibly tiny compared to the Chinese population that's just like, yeah, there's about 15 groups, maybe 20 in a decade. Like, it's just like, it's a kind of a philosophy they don't want to encourage in their own nation.
Yeah, and I think it's something that they don't like it at. I think, and I am not ever like a Peter Zeihan type, like China's going to fall apart. But they have their own difficulties and consolidation issues in the Chinese territory that's contiguous to Burma, because that is still Zomia. Obviously, the power and money that the Chinese state can bring to bear has been much more successful in consolidating Chinese national identity and power in those regions. I'm not even aware of any insurgent groups there. I assume that if they existed, they've been crushed.
There was the conflict in Burma did a spillover. A missile did hit Chinese soil,
which they don't like. That's recent news, right?
That's very recent.
Well, because since the 1027 offensive, the Three Brotherhood Alliance, I believe they're called, which is an affiliation of these ethnic.
So they're three of the biggest ethnic groups working with the previous government.
The
National Unity Government, but also they're apparently not so much like underlings. It's like, yeah, we'll vibe with you at the minute because it suits
exactly.
us. And they also, that, then there's other groups as well.
That's exactly the problem, is that I've seen like a lot of talk from supporters of the National Unity Government that are like, oh, the National Unity Government is in control of all of these territories. And it's like, are they actually in control of any territories? Or are you just sort of putting in these militia-controlled areas as part of the National Unity Government? And it's the Three Brotherhood Alliance. It's not the Eight Brotherhood Alliance or however many groups. I'm not even entirely certain that these are the largest ethnic resistance groups. They
seem to be currently, but yeah, there's that many other ones.
Yeah. So anyway, the Three Brotherhood Alliance has taken border posts with China away from the Tatmadaw, away from the military junta. Yeah, there's going to be some overshooting. I think the Chinese desperately want some kind of ceasefire. I think there was some in recent weeks, wasn't there some talk that they had established a ceasefire in the aftermath, and it came to nothing.
But it's also because there's so many groups, like you can have a ceasefire with one group, but the other one just goes, well, that leaves a window for us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a mess.
You were able to change the situation, what would you do? Would you prefer Myanmar to be several different states? Or what would you do to try and mend things?
No, I mean, so these states are like, I mean, I guess, do any of them have the size to even, you know, aspire to the not particularly functional or independent status of like a Nepal or a Bhutan? I don't think so. So what I think is necessary is, you know, sort of what my dream for Syria and Kurdistan as well, is some kind of established, you know, legally...
autonomous region.
Exactly. An agreement on autonomy that all parties can accept. And that's possible. That's very possible. But that's obviously what I'd like. And I do believe that the Aung San Suu Kyi government, which is currently, once again, jailed. She was in house arrest from 1990 until quite possibly before that as well, but certainly since winning an election in 1990 until 2011. So that was 21 years. And now she's been back in house arrest for another 3 years since the February 2021 coup. What a life to spend your time either under house arrest or as trying to govern Myanmar. I mean, she's been through a lot. And she is, I think, unfairly maligned in the West now. There's this amazing, I don't know if he's still there. No, he's probably not, because I think this was a Duterte guy. But there was this foreign minister in the Philippines who became a mini internet celebrity for just his expletive-laced condemning of usually or Western political approaches. He's quite fun to watch. Often, you know, not stuff that I would agree with. But I think in terms of the treatment of Aung San Suu Kyi, I would 100% agree. Okay, so not only, so this poor woman gets out of house arrest in 2011, has to try to govern Myanmar while working with the Tatmadaw. Like that I think that's something that's underemphasized here is, you know, yes, in 2021, the Tatmadaw were like, okay, this government is done. We're arresting all of you. But this was not a difficult thing for them to do because they were always in control of the government and they were engaged in a process of like, maybe for investments, you know, for the right number of bribes, we'll let this gal pretend to run a government. And that was the situation she was always dealing with.
Is that why she's been allowed to live so long? Because it just feels like with a conflict with so many deaths, I'm surprised she's just been allowed to, you know, live so long.
I think she's I think she's legitimately beloved and legitimately she's basically this is a vast overcomparison, but I think there are some elements of like she's kind, and I think this dramatically overstates the status of her father, but I think to some extent for the Balmar majority she's kind of like Ataturk's daughter, or she's kind of like George Washington's daughter. So I think the fact that she was, yes, not like shot in 1990, because you're absolutely right, this junta has not been shy at all about killing other members of her government. But I do think that they, not just for the Myanmar people, the Burmese people, it's funny, I still use Burmese because I'm not entirely certain how to go with Myanmarese. I think that it's the Burmese people and the international community like would just be so angry if they tried to kill her. And I think that's why she's been sort of allowed to persist. The affection, but she lost to a large degree, the affection and sponsorship of the outside community. And what this Filipino foreign minister seemed to be suggesting that is plausible, but I think probably goes a little bit too far, was that actually, if she had been able to maintain the support of the West against this junta that she had to work with, then maybe there wouldn't have been a coup and maybe she'd still be in power today. And what lost her that legitimacy and that power is the Rohingya genocide that was carried out by the military junta, the Tatmadaw, as well as a lot of the Burmese majority. And I think specifically she is pilloried because I should have tracked down the details here, but I believe at some point in late 2010s, she appeared before some kind of international body, possibly at the United Nations, don't have the details here, and defended what happened with the Rohingya genocide, essentially saying, this was regrettable, blah, 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 but you can't blame us for it. You know, there was also insurgents or this, that, and the other thing. Your sort of standard genocide denial. And she was absolutely pilloried for that with zero sensitivity to the fact that if she had been like, yeah, the Tatmadaw, they're doing genocide, she would have instantly gone back into house arrest and that would have been a coup right there. Like there's zero sensitivity of how difficult a position she was in and the political requirements on her. This is a political issue right now, is that it doesn't really matter how successful the Three Brother Alliance, the National Unity Government is militarily, if they lose the affections of the 68% of the Balmar people, that, you know, the 68% of the Burmese population that are part of that sort of main minority group, and that main minority group was really anti-Muslim, really anti-Rohingya. Like, so not only did she have to cater to the actual murderers, she had to deal with a majority population that was, you know, kind of genocide curious and not feeling too bad about it. And then also had to somehow cater to her international sponsors that were one of the main things keeping her government alive. And I do think that the United States and Europe raked her over the coals unfairly. I mean, there's nothing that we love more than a fallen hero, someone who, because she was seen as heroic for very good reasons for a very long time. And then she sort of became the Rohingya genocide woman in a lot of not particularly intelligent reporting. And I think that certainly, I think it overstates it to say that it's just that allowed the coup to happen, but absolutely it undermined her. And she's back under house arrest and the junta is back in power. So I think the right step forward, the best case scenario would be that the junta says, gosh, we're losing more and more. You know, we don't control our borders anymore, except for the only important border, which is the coast, which is under no threat. Maybe the right thing to do is go back to a political solution and to let, I mean, also Aung San Suu Kyi, I think at this point, is in her late 70s, but to have her govern, well, you know, she's a woman. Mm-hmm. Women live longer.
True.
And under more mentally together.
But it is quite a stressful job, I would say.
Oh, yeah. Unimaginably stressful.
I don't think anybody envies her position.
No. So I think she should. She won a landslide election in 2020. So she and the members of her party that survived should be welcomed back to power. A lengthy but serious process of getting both the Tatmadaw and all of these ethnic militias to stand down to some degree, and to use heavy foreign investment to facilitate that process. That's a process that was occurring between 2011 and 2020. I think this again comes from the somewhat bigoted podcast. They had pointed out that it is actually the potential solution here, despite the incredible complexity of the problem. The solution here is actually not that challenging. You just have to go back to putting the people who won the election in power, and you know what? Throw in some more, even more constitutional protections for the military junta. That's fine. Just put the government that was elected in power and let the positive processes that were taking place over the past decade get back to processing. And yeah, I mean, the Rohingya genocide is a terrible, terrible thing, but I looked it up, and in the first 2 years of the Rohingya genocide, which were the most intense years, is my understanding, 2016, 2017, 25,000 Rohingya were killed, which is significantly less. The number of people that the United States has killed in Gaza over the past 3 months. So I feel like 5 months ago, the Rohingya genocide struck me as more of a deal breaker. And whereas today, I don't really think the West has any real leg to stand on talking about condemning people for genocide. And I think to the extent that, obviously, we want to keep condemning people for genocide, but to the extent that that condemnation stands in the way of a peaceful, progress-filled solution in Burma, then, maybe we can lean back a little bit,
Do you think America wants peace in this region, or does it like having this sort of Mad Max terror zone on China's doorstep?
That's a great question. That is a very good question. That's a great question. I think a great question to end with. I think that there's so much money to be made in Burma.
If
we actually had peace, but there's a lot of money being made in Burma without peace. The drug trafficking, the stateless nature, these are all things that intelligence communities love, leveraged in a number of ways.
And so, it's not like you can't get the raw materials out of a conflict zone.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. So, I don't know. I think, I think it is to the benefit of humanity, to the benefit of certainly, the U.S. national interests, that there be peace in Burma and a resolution to these issues. But when did U.S. national interests ever stop and stand in the way of the Pentagon's love for a war?
I know.
So
sadly.
Sadly. So,
let's hope that 2024 brings peace to
Myanmar.
Or Burma.
Yes, Myanmar or Burma. Indeed, indeed.
Well, at least one of them.
Yeah. I hope this was a decent sort of overview. The complexity of this is infinite. And my greatest hope for Myanmar in the coming year and years is that we actually don't have to get back to it and learn a great deal about it, because it's
a boring country,
proxy war between the United States and China.
People go on holiday.
Yes, I'd rather it became known as more of a holiday destination than sort of Syria too.
Tacky as opposed to terror.
Indeed, indeed. So that's my fond hope for Myanmar or Burma.
And we shall catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.